Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety, and this is The Spinoff. Today we're bringing you a conversation with Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields, the executive producers of the FX series The Americans. I recently sat down with them for an episode of The Business, and that interview had to be edited for time, but we thought we'd give you a chance to listen to the longer version here. Weisberg and Fields' drama about Russian spies living as Americans in the height of the Cold War in the 1980s has been a critical favorite since it began 4 years ago. But it's taken the TV Academy a little longer to catch on. This year, the show finally had their Emmy breakthrough, landing nominations for Best Drama, Best Actor, and Best Actress, as well as writing and more. When they joined us on the show, we started by talking about the moment they each learned that they'd finally been nominated.
We were both on our separate vacations.
Okay.
And I think each of us independently had decided that this was the year we were not going to watch that nomination ceremony, since for sure we were not getting nominated.
Maybe that was the secret. So you broke the jinx by not watching the ceremony.
Although my wife said, you know, the 26th time I told her that this year I'm not watching, she said, just turn it on. And I turned it on just in time to see the Americans get nominated. It was pretty awesome. And then called Joe and started making the other calls.
We'll just jump right in right there first and talk about that. To go from 0 to 100, this was the great, I don't want to say scandal, but the one thing that I think all TV critics and everyone who covers TV or loves TV all rallied around was the fact that there was a great injustice in the world, and that was that the Americans was not being recognized by the TV Academy. And I assume by the end of season 4, you're probably thinking, well, it hasn't happened already, so it's probably not going to happen now.
First of all, that was completely our frame of mind. But also, as you say, that was the narrative. I think we were almost like invested in that narrative. It's hard to like shift now to a new story. I don't really even know what the new story is. Is the new story now the industry has recognized the Americans? You know, how do you even phrase that? It's kind of been a weird shift.
But it's been nice.
Well, what are we supposed to rage against now?
Exactly. Now we're just happy? People keep saying, do you think you're going to win? And that's hard to compute, too, because it feels like we just won.
I think that's right. It does feel like we won. And for so many years, we were genuinely feeling very grateful to just be doing the show and to be surrounded by such a wonderful team that we could truly not feel bad when the nominations didn't come in. But it turns out you feel great when you're nominated. I suspect if we won, that would feel good too.
Yeah, I imagine. just the idea of being nominated this year as opposed to any other year, do you sort of look back and think, well, did we do anything different this year? Or what do you think changed this year with voters or with the TV Academy that they finally got around to recognizing you guys?
Well, I think one of the nice things about making television today is that it really has a shelf life. And people will wait and invest later, and certainly that can still happen with the show. And in the early seasons, in a way, the nominations might have made seemingly a greater difference because a nomination in season 1 or 2 can guarantee a pickup or can bring in more audience. But we really had the support of the network, and so we knew we were sticking around. And now the hope is maybe with the nominations, more people will tune in, more people will watch and be part of it.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning, go back in the Wayback Machine and talk about, first off, the two of you. This was a little bit of an arranged marriage, right? Did you know of each other before you kind of came together on this?
Honey, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, it really was a setup. It was a complete blind date. We didn't know each other. You know, we had the same agent, but had not met that way. And both our agent and John Landgraf, the head of FX, both told us about one another. And then we had a phone date. We had a first phone date where we got on the phone. And I don't remember exactly. I think maybe we talked for 45 minutes or so that first time about sort of the show and just quickly, it was a good phone date. We started talking about our lives and our families. And I think it was pretty clear that we were going to get along and had a pretty similar outlook about, you know, sort of a similar aesthetic outlook, which proved to be, I think, very key.
And I think also we had a similar process and an approach to working together. I remember in the midst of a very intense first season where a lot of hours were spent together, we took time and really talked about our process and talked about how the relationship was going to work and agreed that we would talk through everything with each other and make sure that we were on the same page as we moved forward. And that took a fair amount of investment early on, but it paid a lot of dividends in terms of the friendship, in terms of the partnership, and in terms of the creative collaboration.
I was going to say, this sounds actually healthier than your average marriage, the fact that you guys actually talk this out and sort of, you know, put out some ground rules and also sort of worked on this relationship early on.
Let me tell you, if Philip and Elizabeth had done this early on, there would have been no show.
Joe, let's talk about you. Famously now, we all know that you did work for the CIA back in the day, but you just didn't ultimately dig it. You didn't like lying to people or take us back to what made you, make that career change.
There were a number of things for me. You know, I think lying to people, you know, I went through a sort of a evolution there. When I first joined the CIA, I thought that lying to people would be very difficult for me. And then almost immediately, I found it incredibly easy. I don't remember the exact moment, but I remember sort of looking back after only like a month or so and realizing that I had gotten used to lying so quickly that it was almost strange. But then sort of after a number of years, it started to seem like a little bit problematic to me. But I think the bigger problem was that I had some real questions about the work itself, not necessarily the lying part, but that having worked there for a while and seen a lot of what was being done, that it seemed not necessarily worth the damage that was being done. So that there were a lot of operations being run, that's sort of the technical way to put it, that I didn't think were of that much value, but that had the potential or more than the potential to really damage a lot of people's lives. And I had some real questions about whether or not I wanted to be involved in that. This was not all entirely clear to me at the time. It was sort of forming in my head and becoming sort of clearer as I went along, but clear enough that I wanted to leave.
You know, it's interesting. I think we're a little more conscious these days in terms of the amount of intelligence failures that we see out there in the world. And, you know, we were trained for years, be it because of James Bond or something else, to believe that, you know, spies and our intelligence agency knew all, saw all, felt all, and not quite the case. And we actually see that sometimes play out on the Americans too, where they, you know, a lot of times just really either fall into things or really don't know what's going on.
I think that's closer to the truth, that in reality, most of the work is either doesn't work or is unsuccessful. But that's not to say that some of it doesn't work. And it's not to say that there aren't some successes. And it's not to say some of them aren't important, but that they're kind of surrounded by this vast mass of unsuccessful work. And I sort of think the illusion in the intelligence world, and I'm speaking about when I was there, I can't really speak to now. You know, there's sort of bureaucratic reasons why I doubt that it's changed, but I don't know for a fact that it hasn't changed. So I think the bureaucratic illusion is that you have to do it all to get to the little slice of successful work. And at least what I believed when I was there was that that was not true, that the actual reason that let's say it was 95 or 98% of the work that was not useful and, in fact, probably damaging to our national security because of how it turned countries against us and made enemies worse enemies and neutral countries hostile towards us and friends less friendly, that the real reason most of that work was being done was to sort of give people in the intelligence community something to do and to give them a reason for being and to give them a reason to sort of justify their budgets and a way to sort of advance their careers. So if you were able to sort of trim that all down by a very high percentage and leave a kind of small shell of the work that was really just the valuable stuff or just the valuable stuff plus maybe a little bit of it that you had to just sort of take risks here and there, I think you might have a much more functional intelligence community.
So take us from that to wanting to become a fiction writer, moving to New York. Along the side, you wrote some country songs and eventually got into TV.
Wow, you really did your research if you made it to the country songs.
That's probably my favorite little nugget of information about you, as a matter of fact.
Well, I had always been a fiction writer. I'd been a serious writer since about sixth grade when I wrote my first short story. And I'd kept at that in a pretty serious way really my whole life. So I'd always done that. And I'd written novels and short stories and an occasional play. I'd never really thought that I would do it professionally. I think that I just had other things I wanted to do. And I think a part of me was sort of just also too scared to take a crack at doing that professionally. But after I left the CIA, I thought, well, what am I going to do next? And having been through that experience, also my father died at that time, and that can really put you through a lot of big emotional changes. And I think that more than anything made me think it's time to really try writing more seriously, which is, in a way, had been my first love. At the same time, I had moved back to Chicago, where I'd grown up, and I had been listening to country music since high school, I'd been taking guitar lessons. And so in addition to writing novels and short stories at that time, I was also starting to write country songs. I don't have too much more for you on that, except that that was a hobby that I pursued for a very long time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I can't give you an exact count on how many novels I wrote that ended up in the drawer. Not that I didn't send them out, but that I never published until I published the first one called 10th Grade, which was about a kid in high school growing up in a big school in New Jersey. And then my second one, which was a spy novel, I probably wrote that about 10 years after I left the CIA, when I finally felt that I didn't have to keep the whole thing secret anymore and I could write a little bit something, loosely based on, some things about intelligence. And that book is really what led me into the world of Hollywood, because an agent in Hollywood read it and called me up and said, have you ever thought about writing television? And that's really what led to all of this.
The classic Write What You Know, and that's what led to some of your early credits, like Falling Skies. Joel, let's talk about you now. You're a playwright, and then you did a lot of TV movies early on, sort of during the height of the TV movie, where all three networks every week had a TV movie, and you did a lot of those.
Well, yeah, that was the time. I graduated from college, and I'd been writing plays since junior high school and wanted to get into film and television writing. And at that time, TV movies were incredibly exciting, and you could do historical dramas, you could do romantic comedies, you could do a thriller, you could do a political piece. And I got my first job working in the TV movie business and did that for many years. Many years. And then after all those years, the business kind of went through a constriction, and it also went through a creative constriction where it sort of went from a place where you could do lots of different kinds of things to really they were just making one movie over and over again.
Right, right.
The true crime movie.
Yeah, the woman in peril mostly.
Exactly.
Did you have a favorite TV movie of yours that you did over the years?
Well, there are a couple of that I really loved working on. There was one called Best Intentions, The Education and Killing of Edmund Perry, which starred a wonderful actor named Curtis McLaren, who's sadly since passed away, but also a young Cuba Gooding Jr. It was about an African-American who had been shot by a cop in Morningside Heights, and the cop claimed he was being mugged. And it was the story of his life and how all these people had come together, based on Robert Sam Anson book. And also did a miniseries called Cross of Fire about the rise and fall of a guy named David Stevenson, who was the grand dragon of the Indiana KKK and had almost become president of the United States, which is a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, I was going to say, very, very, some timely topics, by the way, 30 years ago.
And then I left the TV movie business and started writing for television, and here I am.
Yeah, you worked with Stephen Bochco on a bunch of projects, including Commander in Chief. You worked on Ugly Betty, which was such a great show. Rizzoli and Isles more recently.
I feel very fortunate to have worked on several shows with Mr. Bochco and remain good friends. And he's really been a great mentor to me.
Yeah.
Several times a week, I think, what would Stephen do?
That's interesting.
Sometimes I call him up and ask.
Yeah. Was there anything in particular that you took away that maybe you still, as a showrunner and as a producer, you sort of follow the Stephen Bochco ethos?
It's funny. When I was running the first show, or one of the first shows, I sent him an email and I told him everything I was doing. And I said, is there anything else I should be doing? And he sent a wonderful email back that outlined a bunch of his ideas, some of which really boiled down to just don't be afraid, follow your gut, but said much more eloquently. But then he said something I'll never forget. He said, the key thing you're probably not doing is cardio. You need 3 to 4 times a week, 45 minutes of cardio. You're running a marathon. You need to be in shape for this job. And I always remembered that because it's a job you can really bury yourself in. And what he was saying was, remember to take care of yourself in the middle of it. He also suggested vacations with family.
Did you follow Stephen Bochco's advice?
Not in the first season. But later, I think, Joe, we've done a pretty good job of figuring it out, haven't we?
Yeah, I think so. Joel, what about the fact, you know, one thing that is important to us on the show and that is something Joel has really brought is that we are just always really, really far ahead on script. Is that something that really comes from the Bochco school?
He really does believe in that. And I think part of that is from him and part of that is just my own neuroses matching up with yours, Joe. but it's true. We really like to get ahead on script because we do so much rewriting. And when you have half your season written, you can go back and you can tweak your first episodes in knowing things that you just wouldn't know if you didn't have all those scripts.
We should add real quick for folks who don't know Stephen Bochco, I'm sure everyone does, but of course, legendary producer behind such hits as NYPD Blue and is still very active today. I mean, that's a career that I imagine you'd love to pattern after. I mean, he ran his own studio at one point, you know, and several of his shows are still legendary.
I'd take a tenth of it. And since we're talking about him, he's just published his autobiography, so you can check it out on Amazon. It's a great story.
I like that. A side plug. So let's get back into now bringing it all together. So, you know, actually, since you'd been working on shows like Falling Skies, you already knew the Amblin TV guys. Back then it was DreamWorks. But they came to you and said, hey, we have an idea. These real-life Russian spies who were arrested in 2010, maybe that would make an interesting show. Take it up from there.
Well, this was in 2010, really right after those 10 or 11 Russian spies were arrested. And that is exactly what happened. They called me up and they said, look, you're reading the papers. Do you think this would be a good show? And as I somewhat embarrassedly tell the story, I thought in my head, no, I'm not so sure. But what came out of my mouth was, yeah, that sounds great. Let me think about it. And I just started walking around. I was working on Falling Skies then. So I, you know, Joel and I take walks all the time, but back then I took my walks by myself. So I started walking around LA and just thinking, how would you do a show about that? And a couple things became clear to me over about a week or two of walking. One that, you know, instead of making some sort of American-centric show with the FBI or the CIA where these guys were the villains, it'd be much more interesting to make them the heroes. And that, too, it should be in the past. The problem with doing it in the present was that there really weren't going to be any very interesting stakes, that the thing that made interesting would be in the Cold War, that's when everybody was ready to blow each other to smithereens. And in general, a sort of more interesting time culturally for what was going on between the Soviet Union and the United States. And my first thought was really the 70s. Because I just myself love the disco and the hair and all the sort of cultural things that were going on at the time. But, you know, ultimately talking to some people and thinking about it further, obviously it just made much more sense to put it in the 80s because Ronald Reagan really needed to be a centerpiece of this show for so many reasons. You know, after that, it was really just about one by one coming up with the characters and figuring out that, you know, I think it became fairly quickly apparent to me that, you know, what was going to give the show sort of an emotional life was having it really centered around a marriage and a family. And, you know, I talk a lot about the fact that one of the really interesting things that I sort of learned and saw a lot of at the CIA was that you had this weird situation where parents lied to their kids about what they did. And then one day, usually when the kids were older, told them the truth. So sort of having that in the family dynamic was something that came to me very early on. So the pieces started coming together, and we sold it to FX and developed it there for a very long time, very close, intense, collaborative development process with them. I was working with Amblin. I was working with Graham Yost, who was also involved with the project.
Right.
And we just spent a lot of time talking about the characters and the conflicts and doing a lot of rewrites on the script and just adding layers and layers of drama and conflict to the story.
It's funny. Often you hear shows fall apart because there are too many cooks, too many people coming up with different ideas. But this sounds like it sort of worked out, having idea coming from the Amblin guys. You had Graham Yost in there, who at the time was successfully producing Justified and was one of FX's favorite producers. You had John Landgraf, the head of FX, giving you some ideas. You have your entire CIA experience background. And then, Joel, you came aboard.
I had read Joe's pilot and just loved it. And I vowed to my wife that I was going to take at least a year and just develop and not go work on another show. But I had mentioned this one pilot to her. And I got a call from our mutual agent, Joe Cohen, saying that that show had been picked up by FX. But would we be interested in going to New York? Because I'd have to move to New York to do it. And I remember turning to my wife and saying, remember that pilot I told you I loved so much? Would we go to New York to do that? And she just shrugged and said, yeah, sure, that sounds fun. So we were sort of off to the races and then began all of these phone calls that, as you were pointing out, they really did feel like fix-up phone calls.
Yeah.
People saying, Joe, he's such a good person and he's such a creative person, but also a nice and open person. It really sounded like they were looking to fix us up. And then we had our phone conversation, and then really within weeks, I was in New York and we were working together, writing some new material for the pilot that was going to be parts of it reshot and starting to write those first episodes. And, you talk about the collaboration that went into the pilot itself. Really, I think one of the things that's allowed us to succeed in doing the show together has also been an openness to a greater collaboration. So we have an amazing staff of writers. We have these wonderful actors. We have a producing director and all of these people, and we really try to stay open and listen. And on the one hand, we have a very clear idea in our heads of what we want the show to be between the two of us, and also part of what that is being open to this great input from everybody that makes the show sing.
Now, talk about New York real quick. The decision to shoot it there, was that kind of a combination of the tax breaks, the economics of shooting there? But that was also your cast, right? That
was
also
was your mainly, stars. I think it was mainly a combination of Cary and Russell.
Yeah. So,
but it's worked out really well for the show also.
Let's talk about casting real quick. Cary Russell, up until that point, we still knew her best as Felicity, of course. She'd done many other things. But how did you guys zero in on Cary?
It was really a moment of inspiration by John Landgraf when we were sitting around looking at one of these sort of very long lists of every available female actress in Hollywood who was of the kind of appropriate age. And there was a big group of us sort of looking at this list kind of bewildered, not just because it was a long list, but because it's a tough part, a complicated, weird part in so many ways. And to try to sort of look at a list and try to figure out who could do it, nobody could quite figure it out. And John Landgraf literally looked up from this giant list and went, Cary Russell. And, he says that, just not all the time, but once in a while, he sort of has an intuitive sense of something like that. And he had it there.
And Matthew Rhys?
Leslie Feldman, who is the head of casting for what was then DreamWorks, what is now Amblin, had seen him, I think, in a play and also knew his work pretty well and suggested him. Gavin O'Connor, who was directing the pilot, and myself went to see the play that he was in New York, and he auditioned and did a chemistry read with Cary, and he was just startling and amazing with her and brilliant.
Yeah, and obviously, that's lightning in a bottle because that kind of chemistry fell into real life, and obviously they became a real life couple as well. So clearly something was working. There's some good arranged marriages going on this set. the other thing about the casting is, mostly unknowns for the most part. You had John Boy as well. So nice to see Richard Thomas again. But talk about finding these actors who are kind of lesser known, a lot of whom needed to know how to speak Russian and, kind of cast outside the traditional realm.
A lot of it was really just our casting department pulling in these amazing people. Allison Wright was just found by the by the casting people. And I remember her coming in and sitting with Gavin and watching her in her first audition. And she just was Martha. You know, same thing with the kids. I remember seeing Holly for the first time on a tape. We just saw her on a tape that came in. We saw so many tapes, and it was not an easy thing to find a kid like that. But I remember seeing her tape for the first time and thinking, wow, this kid could potentially do that part. You know, as we talk about all the time, people always ask this question, you know, you're starting with a kid who's so young and she's going to have to grow up and mature and be able to sort of carry so much of the show. I can't say that we honestly knew that was going to happen or be possible, but she was awfully good 5 years ago for what we were asking her to do back then. And I think we got also really lucky that she's developed in such an incredible way and is so good and can do so much now, and that we can ask her to do so much. That's really something else. The Russians were a bunch of then and have been even more of now. I think started out, it was hard. It was hard to find a bunch of people, or I don't think the casting people initially were sure how to find those people, but they got good at it fast.
Because we're also very obsessed with accuracy. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't want someone who's a Polish speaker playing a Russian part. It needed to be Russian. And you imagine, here we are, we're already, I think, in production of the first season, we're pretty quickly on our way, maybe stalled a little bit by Hurricane Sandy, and we tell our casting department we need a beautiful woman in her early 20s. It's just a couple scenes in this episode, but we have a major arc planned, and she has to be fluent in Russian. It has to be Russian. And they put us on a Skype with Annette Mahendru.
And the rest is history. I mean, she played Nina on the show, we should say. Let's go back real quick to Holly. You kind of alluded to it, but she's now a major part of the show. You know, part of going forward is the fact that she's now a teenager and she knows that her parents are spies. And there's the big question of, will she join the family business and her struggle with that. And yeah, that takes a real actress. And you cast her when she was, what,
13?
13, maybe?
Is that right, Joe? 13?
Yeah, she was, yeah. I think, 12 or 13,
yeah,
a little older.
So nonetheless, you know, at the time, did you have those plans, or did it sort of, as she evolved as an actress, also your plans for the character evolved?
We did have the plans. We knew that the storyline was going to go in roughly this direction, but I don't think we knew that it would end up essentially taking up this much space. And I don't think we would have written it so broadly, in a sense, if we hadn't seen her able to do so much. In other words, you could tell the same story much more economically if you had to.
And I think this is where not only luck, but the collaborative nature of what we do becomes clear. Think about the talent that Holly brings to that role, and the show wouldn't be the same without it. And you know, Matthew and Carrie's work is nominated this season, and it's easy to look at the show and just think, well, boy, they're terrific. But we see this whole other side where weeks before scenes shoot, we'll get phone calls and they have these subtle questions about the material, and it's clear that they're working on it and preparing, and they create such magic on set. And often one of our great pleasures is watching them deliver performances in ways that are unexpected even to us. Mm-hmm.
Noah Emmerich, by the way, was one of the better known actors,
yeah,
you know, also when we started. And, you know, he's incredible and is then turned into really an amazing director over the last couple seasons, which has been one of the sort of more interesting and powerful things to watch happen.
And then, of course, when you can get Margot Martindale, you get her. And it's I almost sit and watch, and I'm like, oh, good, they got her this week. She's a very busy actress. So.
And there's the marvelous Frank Langella.
Yes.
We're very lucky.
And Joe, your buddy Peter Jacobson showed up in season 4.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Peter is now on the show, which is great. Peter and I grew up together in Chicago.
So I assume we'll see more of him then. He's we're getting to spoiler territory now.
I was going to say, I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. I think we can say that, yes, Peter will be back.
Speaking of spoilers, this isn't if you've seen the show through season 4, but you did do some cleaning house this year. You know, we talked about some of these great actors like Allison Wright and Annette, and it must have been hard to write them out. That the number of these great actors, we won't be seeing the final two seasons of the show.
Well, it's simultaneously hard and inevitable. Each of those storylines were planned out well in advance. So we knew that that's where things were going in all of those cases. What we didn't quite know was exactly when those things were going to happen. I think in all cases, they happened a little later than we expected, because we tend to be a little slower with our storytelling than we think as we initially plan. But we knew those things were coming. But still, we love those people and we love those characters. So it was sad to see them go.
Was there ever an instance of someone who you kept around longer than you expected because you were just digging their performance and you weren't ready to let that character or that actor go?
I think the one big surprise that leaps into my mind is Michael Aronoff, who played Anton. We knew that Nina was going to get arrested. We knew that she was going to be sent back to the Soviet Union, and there would be some storyline there with her that would end the way it did. But his performance was so extraordinary that we were able to create more through their relationship in that scientific facility.
Let's talk about the critical acclaim of the show, because in many ways, the critics sort of came first. Ratings came later. But talk about what the critical acclaim has meant for the Americans.
You know, John Landgraf said very directly that they look at three things. They look at what the critics, and they look at what they themselves feel about the show, and they look at the audience and the audience reaction and ratings. And if they can feel that two or three of those, they have two of three of those things in the positive zone, they'll keep a show on the air. So to say that we needed the critics is an understatement, because the ratings haven't been sort of glorious. Even now, there's sort of a little bit of a struggle. But I think even more than that, just the what the critics wrote has been so sort of positive and interesting and helped sort of create a kind of general interest in the show, which has made it a real asset to the network. And then I think even if you sort of get beyond that and sort of the business side of it, it's just been very powerful for us, because, you know, we write the show and our fellow writers and everybody who works on it. There's a lot in the show that is very it can be at times complex and hard to follow. There's a lot of esoteric stuff in the show, and we work on it in a kind of bubble. And when we read each week these sort of very in-depth, thoughtful essays that show that there are people who are watching it with the same sort of seriousness that we are putting into it, and they are getting out of it what we are putting into it, it just makes you feel like there's a sort of reason for what you're doing.
Yeah, I want to stress the importance of that, because especially in the first season, we were producing the show right on top of its air dates. And as hard as we were working, we would take time out to read all of these, you know, they call them recaps, but they're really analyses. And they would spark these long discussions about the show and what we were doing and what was working and what wasn't working and what these thinkers were seeing and getting. And it really helped us as we were figuring out what the show was.
Was there anything major that you changed, a direction that you might have gone because you sort of saw the reaction, the critical reaction or the fan reaction?
I can't think particularly of change. Maybe you can, Joe, but I think it was more a sense of feeling secure that we could do some of the things that we were doing, and hearing back that some of these things, as Joe said, that may seem subtle, that people were getting them, and that if people were really watching the show, they were catching what we were tossing out. And when you're working in the bubble, that means a lot to hear.
Well, talk about you guys now have the luxury of ending the show on your own terms, these final two seasons. How important was that to split it up to two final seasons? And I know you have this final big document that you talked about at the Television Critics Association press tour, where you've kind of mapped it out. In some ways now is can you exhale? Is you've got a plan, you know where you're going, and the next 2 years now you're just going to do it.
Well, we're not really exhalers.
I was just going to say the same thing. You know, our fuel is anxiety. So,
but you're right. We the first four seasons we had what we called the master document, which is a very long ream of collected beats for every story going through the end of the show. But we got rid of it in between seasons and created this final document, which has the final arcs and scenes for the show. And yeah, it was incredible when John Landgraf came to us and told us that it was in our hands how we wanted to end the show, but not to bleep it up, just in deference to radio. So no pressure.
Yeah.
And Joe and I took some long walks on that, as we do. And I think we knew that it wanted to be two seasons, but we really wanted to test it in our heads and push back against it in our heads because we really wanted to tell the story right. And this seems most right to us. So we're excited. As much as we're not going to exhale, it feels good to be on this path.
We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back soon with more from Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields from The Americans. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is The Spinoff.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
And we're back. It's The Spinoff. I'm Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. We're bringing you a conversation with Joel Fields and Joe Weisberg, the showrunners of the FX drama The Americans. Even though Weisberg and Fields had never worked together before this show, Weisberg says he is constantly amazed by the similarities in their working styles.
It's interesting, you know, we talked about that first phone call where I think we had a sort of what could only probably be described as an initial sense that we had a sort of a similar outlook or a similar aesthetic. I think what was interesting is over those first, that first season and that even more that first sort of season and a half, what we discovered is that our aesthetic and the way we feel about storytelling and also the way we work was actually eerily similar. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. You know, I've worked with a lot of creative people in my life, and creative people have such weird and odd ways of thinking and working that although it's not uncommon for them to have some similarity or overlap in how they think or how they work or how they make their creative output, it's very unusual for them to be extremely similar. People's brains are just too different. But Joel and I discovered that the way we write and think and work and produce is very similar. And that's been very helpful and very beneficial to us. And I think what that's the main thing that's then developed over the 4 years we've been making the show, or now in a way 5 years, is that we've been able to streamline our process and get better at it and quicker at it and more efficient at it. And because in many ways, television is about being efficient. It's not just about being creative and coming up with good ideas, but it's about doing that with a great deal of efficiency because you're working against the clock in certain ways. So Joel was talking before about rewriting and being ahead so that you can rewrite. So as we've gotten more efficient, each year we've gotten further ahead on script, giving us more time to re-break the stories and work with our team to get the stories and the scripts ahead of time so we can do more to go back and fix and rewrite and rewrite. And I think it's been one of the key things that's enabled us to make the show better each year.
And that's also, you guys sometimes shoot out of order, right? I mean, that's allowed your production team to, you know, sometimes, you know, double up on shoots. That's got to be hard for the actors, but that must help you guys in terms of just, you know, keeping the production under budget.
Yes, it's funny. I think Noah Emmerich, who comes from the feature world, is incredibly used to that. But some of the actors who have spent more time in television are really used to going episode by episode. It is more challenging to shoot out of order, but when you have scripts and you also have snowstorms, it can be very helpful to shoot out of sequence sometimes. I was going to say, Joe's answer was so much more thoughtful and eloquent than what popped into my mind when you asked about our creative process, because the thing that excites me about it is that we have a large screen TV that now rotates so that it can go vertically instead of horizontally, and then we can put up an entire page the way a page looks on the screen, which I think is much more efficient because you can see so much more of the page while you're writing. That was going to be my answer.
I don't underestimate that. I like
totally
that too.
Modern technology.
I'll tell you something else that comes to my mind, and then you can edit it out later if it's not that interesting. But I think one of the things, Joe, you're talking about how we have a creative simpatico, and I think on this show in particular, one of those things is, curiously, we both feel more of a pull towards truth than drama. And I think that's been a happy thing for this collaboration on this particular show, because we'll often sacrifice big dramatic moments on the altar of what feels to us true for the characters and just hope that that has long-term dividends for the show. And I think for this one, it has.
Well, and also, speaking of truth and being authentic, we got to talk about the 80s setting as well. And you know, the challenges of setting a show, a period piece, in that, you know, the wardrobe has to be right. The cars have to be right. Dialogue has to be, you know, sort of specific to that era. And keeping in mind sort of, you know, budgetarily, you know, we can't do that because we just don't have access to a certain thing.
Well, one of the great challenges is cars, because if you do a show set in the 1920s, you have car collectors who have really taken beautiful care of their cherished possessions, and they're all pristine and wonderful. But if you do a show set in the 80s, you get these cars that are essentially clunkers, which means they're never going to start on cue. So it's very challenging to cast cars. And then I think we have the benefit of having both grown up in that period. So there's much that comes from memory rather than research. And then there are other tricky things. As you say, it's sometimes hard when you're relying on memory to know what turns of phrase were popular at a certain time, and you don't want to overuse them. You want to make sure on the wardrobe side that you're not doing a thin slice of 1983, but rather showing people as they would have been. Because, you know, people wear clothes from 10 years ago and 12 years ago.
Right, right. And also sort of the stereotypical neon 80s really didn't take place until 84, 85. So you're still – it's kind of a different 80s that you're doing. But also I'm curious from a budget perspective, is that a challenge? Because you have to invest in these props and wardrobe. And what does that do for, you know, just producing an hour?
It costs a lot of money. And that's another reason to be ahead on script, so you know what sets you have to build. And another thing that's a challenge is on many shows, you can just go and grab exteriors. But on a period show, your exteriors are really limited because every time we go outside, we have not only to dress with cars, but there aren't phone booths or there are parking meters that are out of period. Or if you're shooting down a street, normally, cars that would go by in soft focus in the deep background, you wouldn't have to worry about. But, you know, you see four minivans go by in dark, in deep focus, and that's just not good in 1983.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Every once in a while, I'll look at one of your crane shots, like from way up above, and I'll try to look down at the tiny little cars to see how accurate those cars are. So people are paying attention.
Well, thank you.
Oh, we're so careful about it. And when we miss one, we're devastated. Oh. Once in a while, we'll miss something, and then we'll see it later, or somebody will call us out on it. And Joel and I won't sleep for a month.
That's true. In post-production, if we see it, and we have this fabulous team in post-production, they'll point out the littlest things to us when they find them, and we'll digitally try to take those things out.
You're doing a lot more green screen, too. You went to Moscow this year, and you're going outdoors a little more often. The modern technology must be a boon, too.
Yeah, and you know, that's a great example of the collaborative process really working. Some of those exterior Moscow scenes had been written as very production-friendly interior Moscow scenes. And I think the director of one episode and our producing director came back from a scout and said, with some green screen, we can put these characters in Moscow. And so we did.
And we, by the way, went to our – we have a consultant in Russia, and we had a, you know, detailed correspondence with him about how to make the park match a park in Moscow in the 1980s. And you know, it's because the level of detail we're looking for there is we don't really try to just make sure the American audience is okay. We want to have a Russian audience feel that that could actually pass for Moscow too. So we hold ourselves to a pretty high standard with that.
Joe, you early on, I think when the show first launched, I remember reading you told, I think, the New York Times or some publication that you were submitting some scripts to the CIA to vet them just to make sure that you guys weren't doing anything too secretive. Do you still do that or at some point did they say you guys are good?
No, they upped the ante. I was originally submitting just the ones I wrote and then they asked me to submit all of them. So now they all go in. Yeah.
And do they still have any notes or are they still pretty good with it?
Few and far between and always very small. It's never been anything that I would remotely call a problem or trouble. It's you know, occasionally they ask for a very, very small, easy-to-make change.
Joe is used to this because he signed a secrecy agreement and he's used to submitting anything he's written to the CIA. I'm not. It's completely fresh to me. And particularly when we first started. But even still now, I just can't get used to it because Joe and I now write things together and they go in and there's this faceless person somewhere who's reading it. And I'm a neurotic writer, so I just want to know what they thought. Yeah. I don't want to know what secrets we might have accidentally revealed. I want to, did they like it?
Well, and that's a good point. How often do you guys hear from actual spooks from the 80s, folks who were there at the time at the height of the Cold War? And what do they think?
Well, we had an extraordinary experience last season where we met a guy named Jack Barsky, who was a real KGB illegal, and he had been interviewed on 60 Minutes, and we tracked him down and wound up getting to know him. And it was really interesting to hear him talk about his experiences because they were emotionally so similar to the ones that our characters go through.
And I think also that one of the best responses we've gotten, it didn't really come to us directly, but one of the Russian spies who was arrested in 2010 gave an interview to a Russian newspaper in which he talked about the show. And it was, very positive. And he said that he and his wife liked the show and that they pointed out that they were not, wearing wigs and murdering people, but that they found that the show was emotionally very true to what they experienced. And that was, I found that very meaningful.
Well,
that meant a lot.
They say they weren't wearing wigs and murdering people, but what do we really know? Another fun aspect of the show is, going back and sort of these interesting pop culture touchstones, The Day After, David Copperfield, some of the music. You don't overuse it, but you do sort of have those nice Easter eggs for people who grew up in the 80s.
I think that's really our philosophy. It goes back to, started, I think, with wardrobe and realizing that if we put everybody the women in shoulder pads and gave them the big hair, not only would it become have a little bit of a feeling of parody, but it wouldn't match our actual memory of the 1980s. Our actual memory of the 1980s is that some women sometimes wore shoulder pads and some women sometimes had those, big 1980s hairdos. But as Joel was saying earlier, you also had people wearing clothes and hairdos from the 70s and also some who had clothes and hairdos that were sort of timeless. And even looking at ourselves and our wardrobes, that they mostly were, jeans and T-shirts and things you could wear at all kinds of different times. And so if we wanted the show to feel real, it couldn't overdo anything. So whenever we're talking about a pop culture reference, that's an example where it's very, very easy to have it feel self-conscious, to feel the hand of the writer in there trying to insert it. And to guard against that, you have to make sure that it just feels absolutely seamless, that it really wants to be in there. So something like, The Day After, well, something like a third to a half of Americans actually watch that show. So it's really easy to believe that that family was going to sit around and watch that show. And if you're telling your story right, you can also get in that they're watching David Copperfield or that this or that is on the radio. But you just have to take every single reference and subject it to a very, very stringent test to make sure it doesn't feel forced. And it's very easy to fail that test.
One of the ways we run that test is we have a big calendar up in the room we called our writing vault where we write the show. And that calendar lays out the dates in which the fictional show would have happened in the real world. And if there's a scene in which our characters are watching television, we have the post-production department tell us what was on television at the time that the scene is taking place. And they're either watching what was on or we rewrite the scene. But we never put something that feels like a fun pop culture reference in for the purpose of having it there if it wasn't going on.
That's really interesting. That's attention to detail. The other thing I wanted to ask you guys is, do you think there's also almost a weird nostalgia now for the Cold War, for the era where we knew who the bad guy was, we knew who we were up against, what we were up against? There was sort of much more of a definition of the good guys and the bad guys. And obviously in 2016, everything's too blurry. Do you find that maybe in some viewers' minds that this is almost a nostalgia trip to an easier age, an age where that made a little more sense?
I don't know if viewers of the show feel that or not. I get that sense from a lot of people in society that there was something about that time that was easier to understand and something less frightening about it. There wasn't a feeling that, terrorists were going to pop up and shoot you or blow you up. I suppose if you got blown up, it was going to be everybody all at once. And I personally found that less frightening. I think people are different. People have different feelings about that. Some people were very frightened about that and some less.
I was frightened about that. And I think, you know, it's easy to be nostalgic about the past because it's in the past. And it's easy to feel less frightened about everybody dying in a global thermonuclear war during the 80s because it didn't happen. But at the time, we didn't know it wasn't going to happen.
No, and by the way, there are scenes every once in a while where you sort of allude to the fact that we came really close several times and we're pretty damn lucky that it never happened. So coming up next, I mean, you've got two more seasons of The Americans. I know you've joked about spinoffs in the past. You know, maybe, you know, what's Martha's life like, you know, post-Cold War? You know, maybe the wall comes down and we see Martha in 1995 West Germany. Who knows? there's so many things you could do with this show. But what's the plan for both of you guys when you finally finish up season six?
By the way, what kind of ratings do you think we could get for that, Martha in West Germany?
Probably a little better than the male robot show we were thinking about.
Love the male robot show idea, though.
We are talking about developing a new show, new shows. We're developing a few things together that we're not writing but that we're producing. But I think for now, our main focus is on making these next two seasons the best they can be. And when we get to the other side of Fade Out, we'll be talking about what's next for us together.
Sounds good. Well, Joel Fields and Joe Weisberg are the executive producers of The Americans on FX. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Great talking to you.
That's it for this edition of The Spinoff. This podcast is produced by Caitlin Parker, and Ray Guarna is our technical director. You can hear past episodes of The Spinoff on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much everywhere you can download podcasts. You can hear it online at kcrw.com and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. Until next time, this is The Spinoff, signing off. I'll kick out.